the pastor asked. "Not here," Teresa answered, "not that I know of, anyway. I'm not sure if that's the case when he goes up to North Carolina on business. I had to fight for control. Inside, I was raging with frustration. I was asking for help and understanding here, and getting patronizing preconceptions. They weren't dealing with me as a person. They were doing just what I've seen so many people do, come at things with prejudiced worldviews. So I had a choice. According to them, this could be either the devil or drugs." Quite peeved, my Italian anger lashed out. "Drugs. That's it. You figured it out. Thank you for your expert opinion on the matter. They told me I should go into rehab and get professional help. I promised to consider that, thanked them for coming and suggested that they leave. 52, 53, the keepers, I'll get the phone numbers you can use," promised the pastor. "I'll call you back." When Teresa and I were finally alone, I confronted her. "Why didn't you tell them the truth?" Aloof and defensive, she said, "I couldn't. I didn't want them to think I was crazy. Crazy, or in my satanic cult, or shooting drugs with her hubby. Well, whatever." From then on, I never pressed my wife for answers or even support. In fact, from then on she would get hostile if I were even to mention or hint about the subject. Her way of coping was denial. I can't tell you how isolated I felt, how alone, how abandoned. I'd reached out, and I'd been handed presuppositions and platitudes. I had to regroup or I'd be totally lost. After that dreadful meeting with the pastor, I went for a walk. I sat down on a bench in a park. I knew they could probably pull me back from anywhere, but daytime abductions were rare so far. I didn't feel safe necessarily, but I felt I had some space. Again, my indignation and anger was what kept me going. I would make a plan, I thought, managing to steel myself. I outlined the pattern of the abductions in my head. Okay. 3:30 a.m. awaken. Strange lights. Holograms. Symbols. Terrible fear. Static electricity. Despite all this hoopla, though, immediately after the dramatic prologue, there was always an overwhelming urge to go back to sleep. Next time, Jim, 3:30 a.m. lights. Camera, action. No back to sleep, guy. Jump out, get in your car and drive as fast and as far away as possible. This was a pretty simple plan, but it kept me together over the next 2 weeks. True, I wasn't totally myself. The nights were still hard, but I had a plan. I knew what I was going to do. In April, 1989, my tormentors came for me again. Chapter 7, Nowhere to Hide. Sleep is important stuff. Some people resent it because they can't go out and earn money or play or whatever, and scientists still don't understand it totally. What they do know is that while you're sleeping, things get fixed inside your head and body, and maybe most important of all, the chemicals that make life bearable, like dopamine, get manufactured and released. I don't have to be a scientist to know that getting too little sleep in that period of my life was doing me no favors. I felt wretched. I would try to sleep, yes, but it would be a fitful sleep. I had a plan, yes, and I knew that even if I got abducted I'd come back. That didn't help the incredible instinct-level fear and pain that the experiences caused in my head. You can tell your core self that everything is going to be okay, but you are still going to have terrible emotions if something terrifying is happening. And if someone knows those pain and fear circuits and where exactly to hit your buttons to get the responses they want, some people would call that torture. I'd call it my life in 1989. It was 3:20 a.m., 2 weeks after the last encounter, to the day. Somehow I'd managed to fall asleep after the requisite tossing and turning, and when I saw those numbers on the digital clock, I pretty much knew what was up. 54, 55, the keepers, a glowing, green ball of light suddenly emerged from the living room wall. It shimmered and spun, like something from Industrial Light and Magic Cinema effects, only immensely creepier. The ball of light changed, wiggled and elongated. Slowly it described what looked at first like a figure eight, or maybe the sign for infinity. Wobbly. Phosphorescent. Unaccountably I muttered to myself, time for an experiment. Even as the words escaped my lips, I had no idea how I knew this. It felt like a fact, but I don't remember ever being told this before. The familiar fear struck, and with it came adrenaline, which sparked memory. My plan. The urge to fall asleep again rolled over me, but this time I fought it off. No way, I snarled. I managed to force myself off the sofa and lumber back to the bedroom where I threw on some clothes. Teresa was in bed, sleeping. The way I felt about her betrayal had made me think I could just drive off without her. Now, though, I realized I simply couldn't abandon her to these whatever they was. I woke her up. I threw the robe on her. She was groggy but compliant. I led her out to the garage in our car. At the time we lived about 35 miles southwest of Houston in a subdivision called Pecan Grove Plantation. I sped the car away as quickly as I dared, just putting as much distance as possible between me and that glowing twist of light. I'm not sure why, but I took the first turn I could. Unfortunately, there were no lights about, no houses, and no other autos on this road. Smart, I thought. A dark and lonely road, but I pressed on, still trying to gain that distance. Teresa said, "You need to pull over." 56, nowhere to hide, she said it quietly. But her voice and what she said unnerved me. She didn't ask me what we were doing or where we were going. She didn't request that we go back. I ignored her and if anything sped up. Louder, she said it again. When I didn't respond, she did something I never thought she might do. It was so out of character. Teresa's generally a prudent and cautious person, the type that looks all ways before she crosses the street. "Pull over!" she screamed at the top of her lungs. She grabbed the steering wheel and tried to wrench it from my grasp. The car swerved wildly, the lights from our headlights bouncing all over the place. I was so alarmed, it seemed like I had no other choice. I veered to the shoulder, right by a large cow pasture. The odor of manure wafted through my open window. It was pitch black beyond our lights. There was no one about for miles. "Why did you do that?" I demanded. Instead of responding, she just fell back on the seat. Whether she passed out or fell asleep it was hard to say, but she was out and wouldn't wake up even though I shook her. As through that sleep was contagious, a tremendous wave of weariness passed over me. I felt so drowsy, the prospect of driving along a back road seemed ludicrously dangerous. As my exhaustion increased, I realized I had no choice. I turned off the engine and lights, and leaned my head back. Just for a moment. I promised myself. I'm going to close my eyes for just a bit and then I'll feel better. Then came the sensation of something near. The crunch of gravel as though through cotton. The feeling of being moved. My eyes fluttered open. Just beside me was my car, the outside of my car. 57, the keepers. How did I get here? I thought, and then I realized that something was holding on to my right arm. I was standing up, walking like some kind of zombie. I was guided through the field that stretched out beyond my parked car. I don't know how long I walked, because everything was disjointed and wavering. But then I saw something like a dome rising up high from the ground, outlined by trees. Some sort of craft? The fog just drifted over my brain, heavier, until it enveloped me. The next thing I knew, I was exactly where I'd been trying to avoid. The alien schoolroom, with its hard bench, screens and grim schoolmaster included. I had the presence of mind to conclude that the dome I'd seen, the vessel-like thing, was where I had been taken. Even as I sat there, feeling the familiar feelings and getting ready to take my instruction, I realized that without the awful acceleration that seemed to tear my cell structure apart at its seams, I wasn't quite as angry, as usual, nor in exactly the same terrorized state I usually suffered. If the other way of getting to the room was the hard way, then this was the easy way. This was the way I started to view my arrivals here. Needless to say, over the years I experienced both ways many times. And although it might be concluded that I prefer the easy way of abduction, it's no treat. It's disorienting, and confusing. You get wrapped up in that interdimensional field and sometimes you think you've left vital parts of your soul behind. So here we were again, having come in via a different portal to what I came to think of as alien boot camp. And I had company now, other than your friendly neighborhood Gumby workers and supervisor. There was this ant. It was a big red ant, and I recognized its type immediately. It was a bull ant, or perhaps a farm ant. It was crawling around in a circle maybe 18 inches in circumference 58, nowhere to hide ants, right there on the table. And it was a perfect circle. I couldn't see what was keeping the bull ant right on the border of the circle. The voice inside my head said, "Experiment." As soon as the word registered with me, and fitted into my interpretation of that twisted coil that looked like a figure eight, another word bloomed in my head. "Kill," said the voice. Simultaneously, a symbol I knew must be the alien term for kill flashed on the screen, noting that it would be easy to duplicate. I had an uneasy feeling about all this. The voice said, "Draw the symbol to kill the ant." "No," I said loudly. "I won't kill." They didn't like that. I got the increased air pressure treatment. "Kill." "No." Again, the air pressure upped again. My beating heart shifted into overdrive. It felt like there was some kind of heart attack coming on. But I managed to snarl out through gritted teeth, "You will never force me to kill." All I had to do was to draw the symbol and my pain would cease. I tried to rationalize the fact that I wouldn't actually physically kill the ant, but I realized that there was cause and effect here, so it would be the same damned thing. "Killing is wrong," I said. This was the most tormenting moment so far. The agony just got way up there. Desperately, I tried one last tactic. "You bastards will have to kill me first because I won't do it. Go ahead. I'm not afraid to die." The last bit was a total lie. Somehow, despite all I'd been through, I still had the will to survive. I watched the supervisor approach. Well, were they sick of this? Were they just going to put me out of my misery? But then 59, the keepers, I could feel some kind of probing, mental fingers pushing through the fibers of my mind, searching for a weakness. Suddenly, a three-dimensional image sprang before me. I saw, in this video-like image, my brother in a hospital room, clutching his heart, his face red, clearly at death's door. The implication was clear. I had to draw that symbol, or my brother would die. The pain I was experiencing was one thing, but the thought of harm coming to my brother was more than I could bear. I broke down and copied that symbol. Coincidentally, my brother did have heart trouble 10 months later, but he recovered fully. Nonetheless, right there, right then, the big red ant curled into a ball and was still. It died. At the same time, the discomfort ceased. The supervisor alien backed off, turned and left. I just sat there. Tears came to my eyes. Weeping, I said, "Why did you do this to me?" "We had to be sure." "Be sure of what?" "That you're not a killer." "You're not." I completely blacked out. I was put back in my car, a door handle, a wheel and gear shift, a glove box, pine fresh deodorizer. Slowly, things phased back in for me, resolving into a familiar scene. My car. I was sitting in the driver's seat of my car. There was a kink in my neck. My head was twisted back onto the seat in an uncomfortable position. I gasped but couldn't move. I was able to make out a dim form next to me, Teresa, slumped on the seat beside me. Slowly the power of movement flowed back into me. I just wanted to get out of that place, so I turned on the ignition. The sound of the engine rolling over woke Teresa. "Why did you turn off the road?" she asked. 60, nowhere to hide. She didn't know. I was tired. I pulled over. It seemed pointless to explain. "Emergency? Teresa, how long do you think it's been since we left the house?" She blinked. "Just a few minutes." "Well, just a glance at the clock told me that we'd been gone a couple of hours. What did we leave for in the first place, Jim?" I was far too gummed up in my head, too upset and confused to try to explain everything. "I needed to take a ride, and I wanted you with me," I answered, lamely. "Jim, I think you need help." "Yes, I needed help. But I knew that I wouldn't be getting help from my wife." The whole of the next day I was numb inside both mind and body. Damn. I was thinking. Those things can get you anywhere. However, over the next few weeks they left me alone. I tried to open up, talk to friends, but they just looked at me oddly and patronized me. No help there. I tried to get my life and my business back together. In May of 1989, I devised a strategy. All my problems were centered around the whole abduction experience. If I could get somewhere where I couldn't be whisked away, surely then I could concentrate on getting the rest of my life, and my work, back together. I found a hotel, the tallest building in downtown Houston. Surely here I would be safe. I asked Teresa to come along with me, and she agreed to give it a try. 61, the keepers. Even as I checked in, I felt better. It was a nice room, and although home is always nicer, home lately had been a place of terror. I managed to eat a decent dinner, and I took a long bath. I promised myself that tomorrow would be a full work day. I woke up in the middle of the night. The room seemed cold and strange. The clock read 3 a.m. exactly. Something fluttered on the other side of the bed. My heart in my mouth, I turned and looked over Teresa's form, asleep beside me. Hovering overhead, like some ghost, was a translucent owl. Time for school. This time, I didn't bother to wake Teresa. I hopped out of bed and grabbed the suitcase I'd left packed for just this possibility. I rode the elevator down to the garage, got my car and headed for another part of downtown Houston. As I pulled into the parking lot of another hotel, I thought, sardonically, at least they can't get me while I'm driving. Rousing the clerk, I requested a room smack in the middle of the hotel. No windows, please. How long would I be staying? The whole night, I said. I hope. When I got to the room, I threw down my suitcase and flopped into bed. Surely I was safe here. Surely they can't get me here. I fell asleep immediately. I don't know how long I slept, but it seemed like no time at all. The next thing I knew, I was being swept away again, swept away with that low-pitched whirling sound to the place where I did not want to go. Acceleration. Oh, God. I whispered. Is there nowhere to hide? Chapter 8, Abandoned Home. I was falling into a deep depression. My hair had grown quite long, and I wasn't showering. My fingernails were long and dirty. I was drinking a great deal of alcohol. One evening I sat in my easy chair with a fifth of Smirnoff vodka, drinking straight out of the bottle. My right hand gripped the neck of the bottle and my left hand held a .357 Magnum cocked and ready to shoot, as my right forefinger massaged the trigger. I was going to shoot anything and everything resembling aliens, even holograms. Partway into the bottle a loud thump sounded on the roof. I was certain a small scout ship had landed on my roof. I waited, feeling my hackles rise and perspiration growing on my forehead and underarms. Then I heard shuffling footsteps in the attic and then another noise. It sounded as though those things were moving my boxes around up there. I tried to pinpoint the exact origin of those sounds and tracked them with the muzzle of the gun. My finger tightened on the trigger. My heart was pounding and I was sweating like a racehorse. I closed my eyes, but didn't shoot. No, not yet, I thought. Wait until they come into the living room. Moments later, the waiting seemed unbearable. Why don't you freaks walk through the walls like you usually do? A few seconds later, two of the aliens walked from the hallway into my living room, their big eyes shining. They looked so odd as they entered my living room, like curious 63, 62, the keeper's children. They examined my belongings, played with the lamps, walked into knickknacks like clods, and knocked things over. One of them was moving the ashes around in the fireplace. The other kept staring at the TV. Trigger cocked and barrel pointed at the back of his bulbous head, I took a large gulp of vodka, began to squeeze the trigger, and yelled, pretty pathetic, you walk through walls and travel the universe. But you can't figure out how to turn on the TV. I'm going to kill you. But even through the alcoholic haze, I heard what they had recently told me, we know you are not a killer. The sentence sounded through my head, and I knew they had been right. I lowered the gun. The creatures stayed in the house until daybreak. When daylight came they were gone. If the visitors, or whatever you want to call them, want to get you, there is nowhere to hide. In 1989, I thought there was no hope, no help at all. As those things whisked me away from that hotel room, I didn't know if I was going to be able to survive, at least as my full self. However, I did survive. Whether as my full self, I don't know. Maybe I lost something in these experiences, maybe I've gained something. I just knew the whole while that I had to understand what was going on. In the years that followed, even stranger things happened, and I became more and more convinced of the absolute reality of what was happening to me, that I was being instructed by the aliens for a reason. It took me a long time to understand that, but I learned. I also learned that I wasn't alone. In 1994, I took a step that would change my life and put my contact with these other beings in a totally different perspective. In that year, I found real help. Believe me, Houston was not a good source of compassion for someone who claimed the things I did. Neither, for that matter, was North Carolina. Both are pretty much set in their ways, and those ways are generally either secular or religious. So, abandoned home professionals wanted me to take prescription drugs and talk about my mother, while religious therapists wanted to throw holy water on me and pray that my demons would be cast out. I'll get to what happened between 90 and 94 soon, I promise, because those years contain much of what I learned from the aliens, about what I was supposed to do and say as I went out and spoke to people about them. One of the best things I did was move back to the FT, Myers Beach area. My family probably did think I was more than one card short of a full deck, but they were caring and supportive, and I decided that South Florida was where I should be. I guess that South Florida is a lot more free thinking about things, since it's a mixture of people from around the world. In any case, two significant things happened as soon as I moved back. Number one, I started to hear more about the whole UFO abductee phenomenon. Call me unattached to media, if you like, but I didn't get much of that in Houston. In South Florida, however, there's a lot more talk of such things. Maybe the visitors work there more. Or more likely, people are willing to talk more about it. In any case, soon enough I learned that there were others who had had abduction experiences. I was still pretty mentally disturbed about the whole situation, and so it took me a while to get up the nerve. Being at my wit's end was an incentive. In any case, the news filtered down to me. In Florida there was something called the Southwest Florida Abductee Support Group. The founder and leader was a man named Tim Wilson. I called Tim, nervously. I was used to dealing with people who regarded me as an escapee from the loony bin. This seemed to be my last hope for understanding, and I do confess I was perspiring somewhat, and my hand shook a little as I rang him on the telephone February 24, 1994. 64, 65, the keepers, abandoned home trees growing together in a clump. Still, the closer I got to the motel, the more uncomfortable I became. I'd been used to ridicule, but I didn't think I could take any more. Was that what was in store? Or worse, was this some sort of plot, real in the UFO experiences, track them, get their stories, and then control them through these groups? These and far wilder thoughts crossed my head, like, were these the aliens themselves in disguise, testing me? The motel was nice, one of those cottage-style motels, tucked into a relaxed, wooded setting. When I pulled into the macadam parking lot, I noticed the sign immediately, the meeting. I followed the arrow below the words to an open door past which I could see people. I half expected wild-eyed lunatics, but they looked absolutely normal, the sort of folks you'd see in a middle-class mall somewhere. A guy stood up. "Hi. I'm Tim Wilson. Just a guy. No antennas. No ray gun. Hi. I'm Jim," I said. Tim introduced me around. Tonight we had a nurse present, a warehouse manager, a geriatric caregiver, as well as a wide range of individuals in different vocations, and all just people, normal people. "We usually have about 20 people at these meetings," said Tim. "It's a smaller group tonight. There is just one rule here," Tim explained. "To attend these meetings, you have to have had alien abductee experiences. It didn't take long to realize that Tim was intelligent and friendly. He was a person who went out of his way to make Oz feel comfortable, and the way he dealt with everyone in that room showed me that he was firmly committed to helping Po-67. Tim was wonderful. He listened patiently and asked just the right questions. "Look," he said, "I know this has been rough on you. You need to talk about it. I want to assure you, you're not the only one who's had these kinds of mind-breaking experiences, and believe it or not, it really helps to share and compare notes and support others as you are supported. Most of all, it's great to listen, and to be listened to, without judgment. We have a meeting the last Saturday of every month, which means there's one this Saturday evening. Why don't you come? I, for one, would love to hear your fascinating story." At first I was elated. Yes, I would be there. Tim Wilson's family owned a motel, which was the site of the monthly meeting. After my agreement, however, I was worried. I began to think of some of the things that had been happening in recent years. Most prominent were the experiences I had had with men who would come to my home in Houston, after my talk of aliens and abduction, and explicitly tell me to be quiet. Then I would see them following me. Suffice it to say, it had a two-edged effect. For one thing, it made me realize that others took me seriously, even if only men in black. But it also made me quite paranoid about others who considered abduction serious business. Perhaps this was one of the reasons I hadn't worked as hard as I might to seek out this kind of people. I got into the car and made the trip to the meeting. Oddly enough, I lived only a mile from the address that Tim had given me, so it wasn't hard to get there physically that Saturday night. Still, I was upset and hesitant as I drove, and I tried to let the beauty of the scenery absorb some of my anxiety. Southwest Florida has a unique mixture of foliage and wildlife, particularly the birds and trees. It's one of the few places where you'll find coconut trees, pine trees and orange 66, the keeper's bull involved in this phenomenon. He too was a victim, and he made no secret of that fact. Tim had a calming effect on me, and I was glad that I had come. A few people spoke. They had anxiety, a sense of some kind of abuse, psychological disturbances, and maybe a few vague notions and images, sounds and smells, but no one recalled their abductions as vividly as I did. I almost envied them. When it was my turn to speak, my relaxation crumbled. My chest began to tighten and my heart raced. This wasn't just an ordinary fear of speaking in front of a group. I'd felt that before, and I knew the difference. No, this was a feeling that was much more familiar. I knew then that as I shared my story, I would relive the trauma. But these were good people, and I knew that they would do their best to understand. I told them a short version of my experiences, and although it wasn't easy, neither was it as difficult as I feared. Later, it became much easier, and I became a regular attendee at the meetings. Tim Wilson, bless him, also met with me regularly. We hashed out my experiences, and he helped me interpret them. Through Tim and the others, I got to know about people like Bud Hopkins, John Mack, and others who worked with people who had experienced alien abductions. I still felt that I shouldn't read about this subject for fear that it would mar my personal understanding and detailed recall of the events in which I had participated. Now, though, through the group I could act as ally, learn more, and I did not feel as though my interpretations would be tainted. I discovered I had similarities with a group of people, but there were also big differences. I remembered just about everything. Abandoned home I remembered, for instance, being pulled from that hotel room in downtown Houston and set back into that awful room to face an experience I never would, never could, forget. H. That was the problem letter. That was the letter that hung me up, the alien version of the letter H. I just couldn't get the stroke down right. I paused and looked up. The two workers were standing there, placidly staring at me as usual. "Can't do it. Sorry. Maybe I could use some help." Suddenly my arm and hand felt like a long glove that someone had slipped their fingers into. My right forefinger began to move on its own, drawing out each stroke of their symbol perfectly. Amidst my fright at being controlled, I also felt astonishment. "Thanks," I said. After going through the paces before, I had gotten tired, and I appreciated this new kind of attitude toward me.